Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good day, everybody. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today, 17th of August, we will continue listen to Master Tenjin Chosen's program with the book Mind Trainings Like the Rays of Sun by Lam Kapel, and please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Welcome to the program, and thank you for being with us today. Over the last few weeks, we've been focusing on Lojong, the Tibetan Buddhist discipline commonly called mind training. What exactly is this thing, mind training? In a forum with Judith Leaf, a senior teacher in Chogram Trungpa's Shambhala tradition, and Alan Wallace, a former Tibetan Buddhist monk and founder of the Santa Barbara Institute for the Interdisciplinary Study of Consciousness, Ken McLeod, who founded Unfettered Mind in Los Angeles, said, although Lojong is often translated as mind training, the meaning of the term in Tibetan is closer to refining rather than training, and that puts a different slant on it. And Alan Wallace says the word lo in Tibetan and mati in Sanskrit refers more to attitude than mind in general. Lojong, he says, then is largely a matter of reframing our perspective on the phenomena and events that arise before us. We perceive them from a fresh perspective. So, rather than taking the usual tack of trying to transform our external circumstances, we shift and refine our way of viewing, experiencing, and engaging in whatever reality presents to us from moment to moment. Ken McLeod goes on to point out that Lojong is actually counterintuitive because it goes against our ordinary way of relating to the world. It is intended to create friction between our habitual patterns and the experience of the present moment, he says. This friction generates heat to burn up our habitual patterns. Judith Leaf sees that burning not in terms of a sudden conflagration, but as the result of a three-step process. First, she says, we move from our ancient habit of putting our own interests above everything else to the provocative thought of putting others' interests somewhere on our horizon. Then we can move putting others ahead of ourselves. Finally, we can transcend that altogether. It's not simply replacing a this-that orientation with a that-this orientation. It's going beyond this and that altogether. The real rub, the real friction, she continues, is egolessness. Ego of self and ego of other are equally limited views of reality. Ego of self is the sense of self-fixation and fascination, clinging to a notion or of who we are as something solid that can be separated out from the other aspects of reality. Ego of other, or ego of phenomena, is taking what we perceive, all our experiences, our particular mood of the moment, and every thought, and solidifying that into other. We estrange ourselves from the basic fabric of reality when we let our mind have a bias in either direction. Lojong is designed to remove that estrangement. So in effect, Lojong helps in the realization of non-duality. Now this is all very well, but do we truly believe that we can change our basic fundamental attitudes, even if reality is not how we perceive it? Of course, it's fairly obvious we can change certain socially adopted attitudes. For instance, in 2013, Britain's The Guardian newspaper ran an article on a study that found of all attitudes, those towards homosexuality had undergone the biggest change in a generation. The article reads, almost two-thirds of the British public opposed same-sex relationships because they believed they were morally wrong 25 years ago. But according to the latest British Social Attitude Survey, only one in five people now disapproves of gay or lesbian relationships in principle. The speed of change is all the more striking giving that during the 1980s, the number of people who objected to homosexuality was on the rise. In the early 1980s, more than half the population did not think it was acceptable for a gay or lesbian person to be a teacher, and more than 4 out of 10 people did not believe they should hold a responsible position in public life. The latest survey found that 56 of those polled supported gay marriage, which is now on the statute book. Yet several years after it became a legal possibility, opinion is still evenly split on the question of gay couples adopting children, with around 48% for and against and a small number undecided, according to the study. In 1983, 9 out of 10 people opposed gay couples being allowed to adopt children. The report describes the change in public opinion as perhaps the most dramatic attitude shift of all in the last 30 years. It notes, "When we began the survey back in 1983, it was impossible to imagine a conservative prime minister advocating gay marriage. Now, public opinion suggests that widespread acceptance of gay marriage and gay adoption is very much here to stay." We followed a similar trend in New Zealand, so it's quite easy to see that certain societal attitudes can change quite dramatically. But what about attitudes that we have towards what we see as our own inherent characteristics? How many times have we said, "That's just me, I'm just like that," or "That's just how I am, I can't change"? Are we actually just saying, "I don't want to change," rather than "It is impossible"? According to Buddhism, there's nothing we can't change about ourselves if we really want to, and we give ourselves enough time. His Holiness the Dalai Lama puts it this way: "At some point, the question comes up, can we really change our attitude? My answer, on basis of my little experience, is without hesitation, yes. This is quite clear to me. The thing that we call mind is quite peculiar. Sometimes it's very stubborn and very difficult to change. But with continuous effort and with conviction based on reason, our minds are sometimes quite honest. When we really feel that there's some need to change, then our minds can change. Wishing and praying alone will not transform your mind, but with conviction and reason, reason based ultimately on your own experience, you can transform your mind. Time is quite an important factor here, and with time, our mental attitudes can certainly change. The whole reason we can attain enlightenment is due to the impermanence of our mental experience. If any part of the mind was not changeable, we can forget about enlightenment, for a permanent aspect of mind, by very definition, could not be able to be purified. In fact, it could not even be described as purified or non-purified, for it is indelibly whatever it is. So this is why we study and try to practice texts like mind training, like the rays of the sun. Texts that instruct us how to so transform the mind that we can attain an ultimate state like Buddhahood. Part of training the mind is always being aware of our intention, and where we find a limited or harmful intention, to do something about changing it. And so every week we make sure our intention for participating in the program is as beneficial as it can be. So, as is our habit, let's pause now before we go on with the text to take a look at our intention and make it as vast as possible. And that means bodhicitta, of course, the wish to attain enlightenment not only for our own peace of mind, but so that we can help all others also achieve the same goal. Deep inside, I believe, we all want to be free of even the slightest dissatisfaction and to experience the greatest and most lasting peace. So let's make that our motivation for today, not only for ourselves and our loved ones, but for all beings everywhere. Thank you. And last week, we went through the first of the 6 sufferings that Namkar Pal mentions in Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, and that was the suffering of uncertainty. We saw that we cannot fully rely on anything or anybody, either in this life or over a span of lifetimes. As His Holiness says in his commentary, our status can always change. We've had infinite lifetimes, and so friends from previous lives will turn out to be enemies in this life, and enemies in past lives will be friends in this one. We can see the same thing happening within one lifetime as well. So we need to think about those who are nice and those who are nasty towards us, and look how we label them as friends and enemies on that basis. There's no certainty that someone will act nicely or nastily towards us. It can change. This is very easy to see when someone we call our dearest friend says something to us, and on the basis of that, our feelings about that person can change quite quickly. First, we have doubts about what their feelings really are. And then we start to have all sorts of prejudices about that person. Very quickly, this person turns into an enemy that we may hate. So we need to realize that nobody is an absolute friend or an absolute enemy who will always stay in that category. The second of the sufferings in samsara in the list of six mentioned by Namkar Pel is dissatisfaction. He doesn't actually say anything about this, but just quotes from a few sources, like Nagarjuna's friendly letter to a king. Each individual has drunk more milk than the four great oceans, yet in the ordinary person's continuing cyclic existence, there's still more to be drunk, says the first quote. Now, if it were possible to gather all the milk we've consumed from our mothers in all our previous lives, it would add up to more than all the water contained in the four great oceans, and this is what he's saying. I guess in today's terms, we can think of the Atlantic, the Pacific, the Indian, and then the Southern and Arctic together if we want to be pedantic and equate our worldview with the old Buddhist four ocean one. Actually, they are not really separate oceans, but one great stretch of water in which there are some land masses. But I think you get the main point. In all our lives, we've drunk more mother's milk than there is ocean water on the earth. And as long as we don't get out of samsara, we will have to continue sucking even more out of our mother's memories. Namkar Pel's next quote also comes from the Nagarjuna's letter to a friend and reads, "Understand attachment to objects of desire as being like a leper seeking for comfort. When, tormented by maggots, he sits by the fire but finds no relief." A leper's body is, of course, riddled with sores, and if they are not attended to, they attract maggots. To get relief from the incessant itching torment of the larvae, a leper might sit close to the fire. But any relief is short-lived, and where the maggots might be stopped, the burning of the fire just brings another torment. Nagarjuna says that all our samsaric attachments are like that. None can bring lasting satisfaction, and most bring extra problems. Actually, Nagarjuna is taking the Magandhiya Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya as his inspiration. In that sutta, the Buddha, preaching to one of his disciples, Magandhiya, says, "Magandhiya, suppose that there was a leper covered with sores and infections, devoured by worms, picking the scabs off the openings of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a pit of glowing embers. His friends, companions, and relatives would take him to a doctor. The doctor would concoct medicine for him, and thanks to the medicine, he would be cured of his leprosy. Well and happy, free, master of himself, going where he liked. Then suppose two strong men, having grabbed him with their arms, were to drag him to a pit of glowing embers. What do you think? Wouldn't he twist his body this way and that? Yes, Master Gotama. Why is that? The fire is painful to the touch, very hot and scorching. Now what do you think, Magandhiya? Is the fire painful to the touch, very hot and scorching, only now, or was it also that way before? Both now and before is it painful to the touch, very hot and scorching, Master Gotama. It's just that when the man was a leper, covered with sores and infections, devoured by worms, picking the scabs off the openings of his wounds with his nails, his faculties were impaired, which is why, even though the fire was actually painful to the touch, he had the skewed perception of pleasant. In the same way, Magandhiya, sensual pleasures in the past were painful to the touch, very hot and scorching. Sensual pleasure in the future will be painful to the touch, very hot and scorching. Sensual pleasures at present are painful to the touch, very hot and scorching. But when beings are not free from passion for sensual pleasures, devoured by sensual craving, burning with sensual fever, their faculties are impaired, which is why, even though sensual pleasures are actually painful to the touch, they have the skewed perception of pleasant. Now suppose that there was a leper covered with sores and infections, devoured by worms, picking the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a pit of glowing embers. The more he cauterized his body over the pit of glowing embers, the more disgusting, foul-smelling, and putrid the openings of his wound would become. And yet, he would feel a modicum of enjoyment and satisfaction because of the itchiness of his wounds. In the same way, beings not free from passion for sensual pleasures, devoured by sensual craving, burning with sensual fever, indulge in sensual pleasures. The more they indulge in sensual pleasures, the more their sensual craving increases, and the more they burn with sensual fever, and yet they feel a modicum of enjoyment and satisfaction dependent on the five strings of sensuality. It's like a friend of mine who is into heavy metal music and some years ago bought a magnificent stereo set with an amp and tuner that looked like something out of the cockpit of a jetliner and it has speakers for every corner of the room. When I visited him, I admired the setup, but he just grunted and looked a little bit disgruntled. I asked him what was wrong, and he pointed to a dial on the console and said, "The sound is pretty good, but that dial doesn't have a light." This huge stereo with a bass that could shake the foundations of all the houses in the block and a volume that could lift the roof of his own house wasn't satisfying enough because one small dial lacked a backlight. I'm sure that if you look closely into your own life, you can find instances just like that. Nam Ka Pel's next quote has something to say about this. It's from the Condensed Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, and it goes, "Obtaining everything you desire and consuming much on a daily basis, yet still to be dissatisfied, is the greatest disease." In a teaching on the disadvantages of samsara, the nun Tupten Chodron uses the CEOs of banks in America as an example that really illustrates this point. Ageshi was talking about the time of the great financial crisis of 2007-2008, when, as part of the regulations designed to curb bank spending, CEOs had to reveal their earnings. Tupten Chodron says, "Before, CEOs of banks and those people were all getting paid certain amounts. And then the government thought that by making them disclose how much they were getting paid, it would stop what they were doing. Actually, what happened is that the wages and bonuses went up even more because they started looking at each other and saying, 'Wow, he's making that much, getting that kind of bonus. I should too. I want more.' And so actually, the CEO's salaries and bonuses went up because of that, because of people comparing and jealousy." I thought that was quite interesting. And then she continues, "But that's the exact state of mind, isn't it? No matter how much I have, it's not enough. I need more, because there's got to be at least as much as somebody else's, and preferably more. And so we look at the smallest thing that we have, and there's always the mind that anything that's pleasurable, I want more, I want more, I want more. And it's not until some kind of suffering feeling comes that we can let go of it. It's like when you eat. It's like, I want more, I want more, I want more. And it's not until you begin to feel uncomfortable from eating too much that you stop. And sometimes you still keep eating. But this idea that whenever we are seeking external happiness, it never satisfies us. It's what you were saying. It always could be a little bit better. So it's this mind of more and better, more and better. So no matter what you have, it's not good enough. And so that's why the people who live in other countries look at the US and say, 'You people should be so happy, you have so much.' But when you live here and you compare your stuff against other people who have more, then you feel you don't have very much at all. And so the same mind is complaining, 'I don't have enough, I don't have enough.' And the same mind is unsatisfied, even though you have 20 times more than somebody else in a third world country could ever dream of. But it's the dissatisfied mind just keeps going again and again and again and again. And so it's the same thing, not just for possessions and money, but praise. Do we ever get enough praise? Do we ever get enough acknowledgement? Never. Even if someone praises us, it's never enough. Do people ever appreciate us enough? Do we ever get enough appreciation? No. Do we ever get enough love? No, we never get enough love. Do people ever realize how wonderful we are so that we have a good reputation? Do they ever really get it and speak well of us according to the amount that is due? No. So we always feel dissatisfied. No matter how much people appreciate, it's not enough. No matter how much they love us, it's not enough. No matter how much they praise us, it's not enough. No matter how many nice things they do for us, it's not enough. And it keeps on like that. And so this is the fault of samsara, due to attachment, craving, desire, the afflicted kind of desire. And Namkar Pal says, so there is no satisfaction in sensual pleasure, and if you think especially about what is taught in the Sutra Avoiding All Sorrow, you will feel great concern. It says, the water in the ocean bears no comparison with the molten copper you've drunk again and again in hell. The amount of filth you've eaten when you were born as a pig or a dog would be much greater than Meru, the king of mountains. As a vessel for all the tears you have shed when parted from friends and relatives in cyclic existence, the ocean would not be big enough. If all the heads cut off in the course of mutual conflicts were to be piled up, the heap would reach beyond the realm of Brahma. Born many times as a famished worm, the amount of earth and dung you've eaten would fill the great ocean of milk right up to the brim. Basically, we've been born so many times in the various realms of samsara that we cannot count the number of repeated nasty experiences we've had. We found ourselves in hellish experiences so many times that if we'd have been forced to drink molten copper each time, the amount of metal that went searingly down our throats would come to much more than all the water in the ocean covering the earth. Also, as you probably know, pigs and dogs are not at all fussy about what they eat. They even gobble up feces, their own as well as that of other animals. It is known as coprophagia. Yes, the act of eating poop actually has a name, coprophagia. Now, if I said to you that you had found feces just as savory in your previous lives as the local mutts do, how would you feel? Well, we've all been dogs and pigs in many of our previous lives, so we can be sure that we've eaten poop many times. The sutra says that not only have we indulged in coprophagia before, but the amount of poop we've eaten, all piled up, would be higher than the highest mountain we could possibly imagine. For those who don't know, Meru is a huge mountain at the center of the ancient Buddhist cosmology. And now let's all go and wash our mouths out and spend the next 20 minutes brushing our teeth. But it gets worse. In previous lives as a pig, say in Namkar Pal's time, we could at least roam in the forest with some ease. If we were to be born as a pig in an industrial farm nowadays, life would be hellish. The website factsanddetails.com describes such an existence like this. Industrial pig farms can be horrid places. The pigs are raised using the vertical integration method, in which they are packed inside metal roof barns so close together they can hardly move. The pigs do little more than eat and grow before being slaughtered after a few months. Their excrement drops through slats on the floor and is flushed through pipes to huge football field-sized collection areas called lagoons. The stink can be awful, especially for people living downwind from the facility. Even though efforts are made to line the lagoons with impermeable materials, excrement can still seep into the groundwater. Sometimes dead pigs collected for incineration attract wild dogs. Some public health officials think the swine flu outbreak in 2010 originated in a Mexican industrial pig farm. Industrially raised hogs are treated horribly. Piglets are weaned from the mothers at 10 days as opposed to 13 weeks in nature. They are quickly fattened up with hormone and antibiotic-laced feed and never let out of doors. Their premature weaning leaves them with a lifelong desire to suck and chew. In confinement, this desire is often manifested in the sucking and chewing of the tails of other pigs that are made so moribund by their treatment they don't fight back. Oftentimes, the tail stubs become infected. Sick pigs are clubbed to death on the spot. In their pens, pigs are prevented from rooting, their most basic instinct after sex, and the usual means they get food. Male pigs are castrated without anesthesia. So even if we weren't allowed to eat our own poop, life as a pig could be worse than terrible today. The sutra then goes on to say that the amount of tears we cried in all our previous lives when we had to part from loved ones would again outdo the waters of the ocean. And if we collected and piled up all the heads we've had, but that were chopped off in arguments with others, the pile would stretch far into the heavens. Finally, the sutra uses the life of a worm as an example, saying that as hungry worms have become used to eating dirt and dung, we too have browsed on such filth more times than we can possibly remember. Now, thinking about our existence in this way is not calculated to make us feel depressed or anything like that. We're trying to generate renunciation in our minds, a renunciation so strong that we feel nauseous every time we remember life in cyclic existence. We're supposed to think about it until it feels as if our head is on fire and we want to extinguish it in the quickest way possible. Similarly, we're encouraged to meditate on the drawbacks of cyclic existence until we don't waste a single moment in trying to get out of it. Namkapel says, "So as explained, however much worldly wealth you acquire, it is nothing but seduction. You should feel apprehensive, thinking of how the same can happen to you if you do not make further effort." In the words of the spiritual friend Sangpuwa, "From the first, you must face so many ups and downs here in cyclic existence, but nothing worthwhile. Think about this until you are convinced." His Holiness says there is no satisfaction in samsara. "One of the most wonderful fruits that we could have is satisfaction or contentment," he says, "but that is very rare. Someone can have enormous sums of money or material wealth, but if in their mind they are not content with that, they experience the same type of suffering as if they were poor. It doesn't matter how much they have, in their mind they are poor and they suffer. Studies done on the rich bear this out." Those of you who have been with the program over the years may remember one study we talked about, done by the Boston College's Center on Wealth and Philanthropy in conjunction with the Gates Foundation. It was reported in The Atlantic. Some 161 households, 120 of whom had at least $25 million in assets, were involved in the study, their average net worth being $78 million. The article in The Atlantic noted, "The respondents turned out to be generally dissatisfied lot, whose money has contributed to deep anxieties involving love, work, and family. Indeed, they are frequently dissatisfied even with their sizable fortunes. Most of them still do not consider themselves financially secure. For that, they say, they would require, on average, one quarter more wealth than they currently possess." Remember, this is a population with assets in the tens of millions of dollars and above. One respondent, the heir to an enormous fortune, says that what matters most to him is his Christianity, and that his greatest aspiration is to love the Lord, my family, and my friends. He also reports that he wouldn't feel financially secure until he had $1 billion in the bank. The problem with that, of course, is that once he had $1 billion in the bank, he still wouldn't be satisfied. He would want $2 billion. And once he got $2 billion, it would have to be $3 billion. And with that type of mind, he would never be satisfied. As His Holiness says, satisfaction or contentment is very rare, even among those with enormous amounts of wealth. And on that note, we must say farewell, for our time is now up. Please dedicate the positive potential from the program to attaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Thank you, and also thanks for being with us today. I hope you have a wonderful week. Goodbye.